This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. You can subscribe to the app on Apple and Android. Visit FUBARradio.com for more details.
The Lucy Porter Show on FUBAR Radio.
That's what it is. Hello, it's Lucy Porter here for 2 hours with my celebration of women. And I've got the lovely Evelyn Mock waiting to talk in a minute. I'll also be telling you why I should be the new presenter of Top Gear and talking about Hillary Clinton. So it's all going to come up. But first of all, we're going to have a track from our album of the week. Take it away. You don't have to say you love me. I always say that when I'm served. Breakfast in Bed, the first track from our album of the week, which is Dusty in Memphis, which we can talk about a bit later on. Evelyn Mock is here.
Hello.
You don't have to say you love me, Evelyn. Just being here is good enough.
Aw, I will say I love you anyways, Lucy.
Thanks for coming. So nice to have you for the whole show. We're going to chat about stuff. And Evelyn Mock, who is a brilliant comedian, and we have never worked together.
We haven't.
Which is a shame, but is what often happens to women in comedy, where you kind of end up sort of never quite being booked on the same bill because two women still is kind of a bit rare.
No, yeah, we're still a niche.
We are niche. I like being niche.
Yeah.
Long way that continue. But you are Swedish.
I am, yeah.
And I'm very excited. For me, as a sort of slightly lefty feminist, I think for people like me, we perceive Sweden as kind of like Disneyland, in that nothing bad can ever happen there.
Yeah.
Surely, it's all great for women and amazing. And so I want you to disabuse me of that notion. And
oh,
tell
dear.
Me that Sweden's rubbish.
Well, it is very cold.
Okay, you're right. That'll do. It's cold and the booze is expensive. That's the thing people... Do you get sick of that? People always telling you how much it costs to drink in your country?
Yeah, it does. People, especially because I don't drink... I suffer from this thing called being Chinese, where I lack the enzyme that breaks down wheat.
Yes, and so does that mean if you attempt to drink? Have you ever attempted to drink?
I do on special occasions like New Year's and maybe my birthday sometimes.
And then suffer?
And then suffer profusely. I get very red in the face, and I also I get, depending on what mood, either I get very sleepy very fast, or I get very happy very fast, which is the good version. But that only lasts for maybe an hour or two, and then I want to go home.
Well, do you know what? For the second hour of the show, I've brought in some cans of Pimm's.
Yeah.
We could do a live experiment on it. Because my best friend Helen, who is Chinese, has managed very bravely to drink her way through the lack of enzyme.
Oh, that's amazing.
But yes, she has. It's a cheap date. Very cheap.
Very cheap. Very cheap date.
Which is like being small, like me. I'm like, yeah, you know, just the sniff of a barmaid's apron. That's all I need. So it's all good. And how long have you been living in Britain and applying your comedy trade over here for?
Oh, I've been here since 2012, September. I came over. I was doing like an Erasmus exchange.
Yes, I've
at school.
It,
yeah. So the EU helped me come here to take advantage of your education, and then I just stayed.
Slightly less cold weather and
yeah, exactly.
Plentiful cheap booze that you can't really enjoy to the full. Never mind.
But I do enjoy watching people get drunk.
Well,
that's quite fun.
Thank God for that, because there will be a lot of that happening. We should say that tonight we're recording this on Wednesday. Hello to the live listeners as well. We do have a couple. I know this. One of them texted me. Tweeted. That's what I'm trying to say. One of them tweeted me, and somebody else has emailed to say they've enjoyed the show. So thank you to those people for that. But we're on the hottest day of the year so far. And the studio, the wonderful FUBAR studio, is directly next to a pub where we have seen the red-faced, sweating, topless men of North London doing their traditional beginning of summer ritual of taking their tops off and shouting.
Yeah.
It's very nice. We'll see a fight later, probably. Great.
I'm very excited.
I know. You're welcome. We will be kind of talking about all sorts of comedy things, I would imagine, but also this show being a celebration of women. I have a couple of women up my sleeve, but did you have a woman that you wanted to share with us that you're particularly fond of, Evelyn?
I have sort of a group of women, but I quite like... I was one of the first women in space. Well, the third first woman in space is Sally Ride from America.
Yes,
who I find very fascinating and inspiring. She went up in, let's see, I'm going to peek in my notes. She went up in 1978, and she was the first woman to use a robot arm in space,
cool.
which just makes her very cool.
We've all seen Sandra Bullock doing it in Gravity.
Exactly.
It's a disastrous effect. So Sally Ride was the pioneer. Is that a fondness for astronomy generally, or...?
It's probably more fear, because I think I have a fear of being lost somewhere where you wouldn't be able to get back. Maybe like out at sea would be crazy.
And space would be pretty much the most lost you could ever be. Have you seen Gravity?
I've seen Gravity, yes, but I haven't seen Interstellar.
No, I haven't seen Interstellar either. Is that similarly terrifying?
I think so. I think they say the story is better. But Gravity might be visually more appealing.
I went to see it at the IMAX, which was, because there is basically no story, but there is a lot of cool stuff flying at you. And I, as you said, you don't drink. I don't really get stoned. And I've never felt more of a want of being stoned than watching Gravity in the IMAX in 3D. I thought this is an absolute waste. I've taken a ticket from someone who could have been happily baked watching this going quietly out of their mind. So I'm sorry to the stoned person out there whose ticket I took for the IMAX Gravity experience. But who was there? Helen Sharman was always our female British space expert. I'm looking at producer Amanda. Mm.
I don't know. That name is not familiar to me, actually.
I'm pretty sure. I'm going to look her up in the next break and we can discuss further ladies in space. Because would you be tempted? I mean, I presume not, given what you've said, Evelyn, but would you be tempted to go on Richard Branson's space tourism venture?
Was it the one that you never can come back?
No, that's the mission to Mars, which, that sounds pretty bad.
That would be very freaky. Never being able to come back to Earth. That's
there
crazy.
There have been days where I felt that would be not entirely a bad thing. But yes, generally. No, Richard Branson is selling seats on a kind of space shuttle thing where you can go up and hopefully come back. I don't know what the insurance must be incredible for that. Imagine that going, listen, we've never tried it before, but we think it's going to be fine. Go compare. Can you find us an insurance quote for that? I mean, I'm not tempted in any way. I love the idea of space. I love space films. But it's like, as you say, diving, sea. Not again the beautiful space under the sea. I did once attempt to do my diving paddy, which is the thing you have to do before you're allowed to go and dive, and I had booked a diving holiday because I'm nothing if not confident. And I thought, this will be fine, dive in, that'll be great, it'll be fine. And I went to a school swimming pool in the Barbican in the City of London in January and spent a day, a Saturday morning, in the coldest swimming pool I've ever encountered, lugging about, and I am physically quite weak, and lugging about this equipment, and everybody else who was there that day passed their paddy and was allowed to go off and dive.
No.
And I was the only one who was held back. And they said, you will need remedial lessons. And I said, you know what? It's not for me. It's just not for me. I've decided.
It's not worth it.
No, frankly, I'll snorkel and be happy with that.
But would you, if you would have taken the remedial lessons, would you have been the person who, at the lessons, just be a bit like, oh, I've already gone through this once.
Yeah. I'm an old hand.
Exactly.
No,
I know what I'm doing here.
And then drown an hour later. That's very much the way it goes. I have a history of failing things other people find easy. My guitar grade one exam when I was 7 or 8 years old, and everybody else passed it from our little guitar class in our school, and the headmaster had to call me in ahead of the ceremony where they were going to present all the certificates. And he said, I think, Lucy, I think it's because your hands are very small.
Oh, bless him.
That you're not very good at playing the guitar. And he tried to make me feel better. But yeah, the humiliation has never quite left me. So.
But I mean, for someone that young, can't you just pass the person?
You know, you would think, wouldn't you? In Sweden, I bet they would. Yes. I think that's it. I think this is why Sweden is a paradise.
That's the secret. We've just been passing everybody. And now it's just fantastic.
I know. Just the sort of cruel to be kind school of education was the one that I went to. So anyway, gosh, what a depressing start to the show. I'm sorry, and we were talking about women in space, got an amazing Sally Ride, being brilliant. Is she in your group of women? Is it the, what's the group?
Yeah, my group is of the women in space. The first woman in space was Valentina Tereshkova.
Naturally Irish.
Mm-hmm.
The Irish space program. Yes, tell me about her. What was her, when did she go up?
She went up in 63.
Yeah.
And she was like, I think she was 26 years old, had no formal education as anybody who would be qualified to go up into space. But she was like a factory worker. She had a hobby of being a skydiver.
Wow.
So that's where, and the Russian government at the time, they just came up with the idea of let's send a woman into space.
We've done a dog.
Exactly.
Next stage, let's do something else that's expendable. Although actually, you know, say what you like about communism, they allowed women to do all the scary, dangerous shit before anyone else, didn't they?
Mm.
But she made it back.
She made it back. She orbited 48 times during 3 days, and she made
like
it back.
Sounds like the worst roller coaster ride ever.
Exactly. She was actually quite queasy throughout the whole thing, but she stuck it out. And then the thing is, it was sad because she wanted to go back up, but wasn't allowed. I'm not quite sure why she wasn't allowed.
That's communism. You've had your turn.
Thanks.
You've had your chance. It's another factory
worker.
Don't
think you're better than anybody else.
Yeah.
Let's stay here on the ground. But she's actually chosen to be part of the non-coming back people who are going to Mars.
Has she?
Or she wants to be.
Yes.
So she said that she wants to. But she's really old now. I don't know how that affects your space.
I would say it's
survival
the best
chances.
I mean, were I a little older and did I not have children, I think I would totally
do it.
Yeah, why not? Really? What a way to go.
I couldn't think of anything worse.
Well, Amanda, you would miss. You're much more of a sociable person than I am. I quite like the idea. I'd actually like to go on my own. I don't even want to go on a mission. I just want to be catapulted up into space on my own.
I'd be worried about who I was going to be stuck there with for the whole of eternity.
Yeah, it's because a great sitcom premise, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that is. Yeah.
It's like porridge in space with...
on Mars.
Yeah. So women in space, shall we explore that? Let's make that a theme throughout the show. We'll come back to other women in space, and I'm going to look up... I'm saying Helen Sharman, and I'm now doubting myself, but I'm pretty sure that Helen Sharman was our first British woman. Anyway, we will find that out. I am going to... Now, the woman I would like to pick as my heroine of the week, it relates to a topical news story, which is Hillary Clinton announcing that she's going to run for the Democratic nomination. Now, I'm quite excited about it. I quite like Hillary. I like, very good name, like Evelyn. See, Evelyn, very good name in that it can do the duty for a man and a woman.
Yes.
As Hillary, I like those kind of names because I think it allows you, I think you get on in life more where people are going to go, oh.
Let's find out. Let's go in for an interview.
Is it as in war or as in, I was trying to think, female Evelyns. Are you familiar with the work of Evelyn Champagne King?
No, but I want to change my name to that now.
Evelyn Champagne, I can't have it.
Oh, yeah.
Evelyn Sparkling Elderflower, passe. I think it's a brilliant...
Absolutely fine.
Yeah, Evelyn Champagne King. That's a good little name.
Amazing name.
But yeah, she... In fact, well, we could try by then. If not by the end of the show, by next week, we'll find Love Come Down was one of her songs.
Oh,
and
right.
Shame. We shall see. If it's on the system, we can play it. If it's not, then we won't. But yeah, anyway, so Hillary Clinton, who has a unisex name, running for president. And with no apparent opposition, really. I mean, it looks like she probably will get the nomination, at least.
Yeah.
She may or may not become the first female president. But the woman I wanted to draw our attention to is another woman who wanted to be a Democratic president of the United States, and she's a woman called Shirley Chisholm. Are you familiar, Amanda and Evelyn, with Shirley Chisholm?
Not at all.
No.
Well, let me enlighten you. She is the most brilliant kick-ass role model I think you could ever have. Shirley Chisholm, not only a woman, but also an African-American woman who became the first major party black candidate for President of the United States in 1972.
Wow.
Before any of us were born. She came from sort of reasonably humble beginnings. She was born in Barbados. Her family arrived in New York City aboard the SS Pocone on March the 8th, 1921. Her dad worked in a factory making burlap bags and her mum was a seamstress and domestic worker. Shirley got sent back to Barbados to live with her grandmother. She came back to New York and she then became a teacher. And she was interested in education and kind of issues around that. And she decided in 1968, she ran for the US House of Representatives. And she became Brooklyn's first black member of Congress. And then decided that she was going to run for president in 1972. It's a fascinating story. I urge you to look it up because obviously I'm not going to be able to do it justice now. But she was... when she was elected to Congress, she was slightly annoyed because she was given... her first job was... she was assigned to the House Agricultural Committee. And she said, look, I'm from a very urban community in Brooklyn. Why are you putting me on the Agricultural Committee? And she was slightly disheartened. She thought, oh, they're trying to sideline me. They're trying to put me in something where I've got no interest and it's not going to help my people. But she then had a chat with a rabbi who said, listen, you've got to use this to help the poor and hungry. So she worked to expand the food stamp program. She played a critical role in the creation of the special supplemental nutrition program for women, infants and children. And basically she has been credited for the fact that so many poor babies now have milk and poor children have food. So she was an incredible crusader. And then she stood for the 1972 Democratic candidacy for president, and her slogan, which I think is the most brilliant kick-ass slogan, was "Unbought and Unbossed."
Wow,
it's good, isn't
that's
it?
Very good.
I think Ed Miliband should take that now. Take that on. Unbought and unbossed. And anyway, she obviously wasn't elected president, otherwise we'd know about it. But she spent years basically campaigning on education and the welfare of children. And she died in 2005.
Wow.
And I think she should be better known because it's an incredible achievement that she, you know, at that time. And she said, interestingly, she said that actually... it was being a woman that she felt held her back more than being African-American because she felt like men look out for each other first, regardless of race, which I thought was quite an interesting story.
Yeah.
So that's my woman of the week.
Well, she's fabulous.
She is fabulous. Yeah. So, but, you know, and not to take anything away from Hillary Clinton. I think it's somebody tweeted, but I'll try and find out who the tweet was from because it really made me laugh, though, that they really want Hillary Clinton to become president because it will mean that two of the presidents will have had sex with each other. It's just, I don't know why that makes me how, but I love that. I mean, maybe we don't know. Others may. I mean, hopefully not George Bush Sr. and George Bush Jr. That would be wrong in some anyways. But yes, it's and I think it's a fascinating career trajectory as well for her. The idea of being a presidential spouse to being a presidential candidate is because I always hoped. Now, Evelyn, I am not sure if you will be familiar with a politician called Neil Kinnock. I'll give you a little lesson in Neil Kinnock in the 1992. UK general election, we all thought he was going to become Prime Minister. Mm-hmm. He was leader of the Labour Party, very nice Welshman, catastrophic election campaign, and he didn't get in. But he was married to a woman called Glynis Kinnock, who I still have a massive crush on her, and I always thought she would have been an amazing Prime Minister. Because she became an MEP, didn't she?
Yeah, she did. Yeah.
So she had a political career. But I think it is fascinating that now Hillary Clinton, after all those years of seeing the job from within, is now doing it. I was trying to think who of the current partners of leaders from our current general election. who you think you would like to see go on to have their own political career? Because Samantha Cameron is... I always feel sorry for Tory wives because I think they are expected to be a little bit more subservient than their left-wing counterparts. She may have a lot of spunk, I don't know, but I really like Miriam Gonzalez Durante.
Yes, she's, Nick Clegg's wife. She's, yeah, yes.
I've got a lot of time for her.
But also... Ed Miliband's wife is
Justine.
She's a lawyer, nice, isn't she? She's an environmental lawyer, so she's
lovely. Do you know? Right, can I tell you a story about her?
Please do.
I used to go out with someone who was way out of my league financially.
Surely not.
And possibly in every way, but financially certainly. I was at a sort of a dinner once, and for some reason, I don't know why, I started talking about school dinners. And about, like, when you were at school, did you have packed lunch or did you have school dinners? And I realised that everyone else that's in the party was, like, suddenly being really weird and a bit odd. And I was like, I didn't think this would be controversial. And it was. And one of them eventually said, oh, no, well, it's just that we all went to boarding school. So yeah. We didn't really have it. And I was like, oh, no. And she was there and she was lovely. And she was the one who kind of went, oh, God, you know, it's fine. And because I don't know, I think she might have been stay educated anyway. But so she was very nice and she rescued me from my slight being a pleb in amongst posh people trauma. So I have a very soft spot for her, frankly. but yes, so yeah, I mean, Hillary Clinton, more power to her. It will be interesting to see who they field against, because I think if it is Jeb Bush, then the idea of a Bush-Clinton head-to-head for presidency, that's the one where the drama and the theatre is going to happen, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think it's going to be Jeb, isn't it? That's the.
It would be interesting if they put forward Sarah Palin.
It would be
very funny. Yeah.
It's another woman. Come on, let's do
exactly.
it.
Steady on.
Let's do the woman out. Well, it would at least make the Tina Fey and Amy Poehler scenario come alive again. So, yes. But yes, that's my woman of the week. We've done our women of the week.
Great.
Shall we have a song?
Track, shall we? This is very tenuously linked to the subject that we've just been talking about.
How tenuous?
It's so tenuous. Here we go.
On FUBAR Radio.
It's a very enthusiastic rendition of my name, that is.
He's so excited.
I don't know who that is, but I'm glad he's so thrilled that we're here. I'd quite like a musical. Could we arrange for next
Lucy
time?
Lucy Porter.
Lucy Porter on FUBAR Radio. I listen to a lot of Magic FM. In fact, Kim Wilde, who we just heard there, Kids in America, because we were talking about America. Well done, Amanda. No, very good. Hillary Clinton is American, and we are British, and Kim Wilde is British. It all fits. It's marvellous. But yes, Kim Wilde, who is a presenter on Magic FM, and for Evelyn, the benefit of Evelyn Mock, our studio guest, raised in Sweden. Again, probably not familiar with the work of Kim Wilde.
No, none.
I love the way I'm just presuming you know none of our cultural icons, and I will talk you through all of them.
The thing is, I've been here for 2.5 years. I should.
No, Kim Wilde. I mean, you know, Kim Wilde was the 1980s. She was the sort of sex kitten, sort of the cool pop star to be in the early 1980s. And I have loved her as long as I can remember, because she did that song Kids in America and various other which we may play another one before the evening's out, you never know, but she was just the coolest woman. And then she went on to be a gardener. She's now a gardening expert.
And there's
a lovely YouTube clip of her that you must find, which is her drunk on a train.
I love
Christmas.
That
and somebody starts singing one of her songs and she just joins in because she's drunk and she's lovely. And
she's wearing reindeer antlers as well because it's Christmas. So
yeah,
it's proper office party style. They're a bit skew-whiff, aren't they?
And she's just pleasantly tipsy and a very nice, like you or I, Evelyn, after one glass of wine. Yeah. I absolutely, absolutely adore her. So yeah. I'm glad you picked that reference.
Thank you.
Very good.
Yeah.
Anyway, yes, but where were we going before that? What was I going to talk about?
I'm going to talk about... you've been looking up.
Oh, Helen Sharman, yep. Yes, another woman who was a formative influence on me. So Helen Sharman, who was not only the first British woman in space, but the first British person in space on the Juno mission, Project Juno, in 1989, which is why I remember it, because it was a very significant time for me. I was 16, I was thinking, what do I want to do with my life? where am I going to go? And I looked at her and I thought, not into space. Not into space. I love what she's done, but it's not going to be for me. So, yeah, she was... and she also, she went back. Isn't it... This is interesting. What we're coming up with now is that women who go into space, I guess people who go into space, they want to go back once you've been.
It must be a mighty, mighty thing to see. Yeah, because you appreciate how small Earth must be.
Yeah. And what else in your life could ever compare when you sort of go, well, I've been into space, you know, where could, I mean, you know, I'm sure Sweden's very nice. I've been all over the place. I've been to Hull. I love Hull. I mean, I think Hull is a really, really fine place, but
surely
to
Hull
space,
must be better than space.
Well, I mean, it's got a lot going for it. The drinks are cheaper and the people are friendlier, but no, it's, yeah, incredible that you would do that. And then, but yeah, she worked, oh gosh. Her early life, Helen Sharman, the first British woman in space, she worked as an engineer for GEC in London and later as a chemist for Mars Incorporated, dealing with flavourant properties of chocolate.
Oh.
She worked with chocolate because she liked chocolate and wanted to explore the further flavours and scents of pure alpine chocolate.
Oh, that sounds like my dream career.
Exactly. Yeah, chocolate and
chocolate.
Space.
Chocolate.
Just the chocolate. Just the chocolate. That's just absolutely fine.
Chocolate and space too, as long as there's chocolate. I'd probably be fine.
If she was on the Mir space station as well. She went back. Hang on.
Ooh.
Anyway, yes, I think she went back. Look at me scrolling through. So, yes, women in space. I tell you what else I was going to set up, actually, during this show, is I wanted to compile a list, and I haven't thought of any ideas for this, but I'm hoping that we in studio and our beloved listeners will come up with something, was ways I have disappointed my mother. This is a list I would like to come up, because it came out of a conversation that Amanda, the producer, and I were having after a show we did the other day, and we were talking about how amazingly competent at housekeeping our mothers are. And how amazingly not competent at housekeeping we are. And in fact, I was discussing, because on last week's show with Tanya Edwards, I was discussing the fact that I used to work on a programme called Anthea Turner, Perfect Housewife, where I wrote the script for a show which was all about teaching people how to be amazing at housework, and I learned nothing. I know nothing. So I have been sort of, I mean, gently turning it over in my mind, and I think... You know, that sort of period when I was 16, when I was all into Helen Sharman and like this amazing, the potential that I have in my life. And I remember my mum sent off an application for me to do like a sort of law work experience thing, because I sort of said, oh, I think I might quite like to be a lawyer, I don't know. And she sent off an application and I got accepted to do this sort of work experience placement thing. And I pretended to go. And did not go.
Where did you go?
Where did you go?
I kicked about the park with my mate.
No.
And she would never have found out, except a few years ago, the weight of it became too much.
Really?
Yeah. Because she said, oh, it's a shame that, you know, when you did that law thing, it never really worked out for you and you didn't, you know, you didn't really get on with it. And I was like, yeah, I never tried it, mother.
Do you have regrets for not doing it?
No, I don't think it would have suited me.
What did you say when you came back from the park, though? So obviously you were asked about it.
Yes, and I made up incredible things about it. I think it did prepare me for
I got somebody off of a murder charge today.
Did so much filing.
Yeah. And then I realised towards the end of the week, I thought, oh, well, I'm going to have to slightly talk it down, because otherwise she is going to think my daughter is a genius at law and she's going to go on to become a lawyer. So it was like a sort of, you know, there's that old joke about... someone's on holiday and they've got someone in to look after their cat, and they phone up and the person says, oh, sorry, your cat's dead. And they say, oh, well, you could have broken it a bit more gently, you know, you could have said the cat's on the roof, and then the next day you could have said, oh, the cat's still on the roof, and then eventually the cat's died. And then they phone up again from holiday and they say, how are things? And the person looking after the house says, well, your mum's on the roof. Classic old gag. But so I kind of did that with my mum, where sort of towards day four I went, oh, actually, do you know what, things aren't as great as I said they were.
So this was a whole, how long did you have to loiter in the park?
8 hours a day.
So you
I
were
put
like,
in a really good week at the park.
You were like one of those people that
working week at
that pretend
park.
They've got still got a job when they haven't. And
yeah,
have to
yeah,
go
yeah.
This
I know
she
made me
day.
Sandwiches and everything, and I would sit and eat my sandwiches.
Did you get more and more tanned and come
yeah,
back?
Yeah, yeah. I was like, oh yeah, the law it involves a lot of work outside. Yeah, exactly. It's a lot of walking from case
you wouldn't
to case.
Understand, mother.
Yeah, the Old Bailey has got no roof. Did you not know that, Mum? Yeah, no, the Old Bailey all very open plan now. So yeah. That was a big one. That was a big
yeah, that's quite. And how did she react when you told her then? Was she?
Oh, I mean, the same sense of sort of mild disappointment that I think she's become used to over the many years. It was sort of the culmination of sort of subsequently I've done a lot of things that have been quite disappointing. But I think that's the first one I can pinpoint as being a real kind of betrayal of her trust and expectations. So yeah, that's my. So if you can think either of you guys and anyone at home,
well, I mean, as I just said the other day, the fact that I don't change my bed sheets on a weekly basis.
Yeah,
I think she's.
When you say not weekly, Amanda?
Well, I just say as in not every 7 days, Lucy.
So what, you leave it like 8 or 9 days, do you, Amanda?
Or
a little bit longer than. Let's put a rough ballpark figure on how often you change your bed sheets.
It depends on the time of year, because in the winter you don't really sweat that much in bed. So
yeah, I mean, you know, exactly. I mean, I think 6 months, I think the whole of the winter is fine, and then, you know, you could have a winter set of bed linen and
I, see, that's, yeah. I don't have a summer duvet and a winter duvet, that's probably, and I don't pack away my summer clothes and then get them in a vacuum pack thing, get them out,
no.
And then replace them with my winter clothes. I don't do that either. So I think...
No, my idea of going from winter to summer is I remove my cardigan.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's it. And swap opaque tights for leggings.
Yeah.
Or on a very nice day, bare legs.
And open the window a bit more.
Yeah. That's a bit, winter to
that's
summer.
About that.
How often do you change your bed sheets? Yeah.
I just changed them, actually.
Good work.
I
Is
did.
That since you arrived in the country? Yeah.
Exactly.
2.5 years. I've been here long enough. I think I'll do
2.5 years. They're starting to smell a bit. Let's change them. I changed my bed sheets, or I changed my duvet cover and my pillow covers, but I didn't change the sheet on the bed.
Yeah. Right. So I'd argue that's the most crucial bit to change. But, far be it from me.
And also my bedding doesn't match as well. The pillowcases don't match the whatever duvet
You haven't got a valance.
Sadly not.
Who has a valance these days?
I have that valance.
Yay, okay.
I have to have it match because my mother didn't care about it matching. So I think that's where it
you
came from.
It.
Yeah, exactly. I'm doing
generation.
Everything opposite.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's
from
because
my
grandmother wasn't particularly house proud. My mum was, and I'm not. And I think so. My daughter is already. She's only 4, but she's showing signs of being a bit like, come on, can we just? Because we've got next door neighbours who are very clean, and she goes round to their house and then she comes back and
she looks
like,
at how it could be for
her. Could we sort this whole thing out? Do you know? I used to have a bachelor friend of mine who confessed to me that instead of changing his sheets when they got really too. Sort of waxy and hard to be comfortable anymore.
Ooh.
He would turn
waxy.
Them waxy.
That sounds gross.
Wax.
You're not a boy, right? I don't even know wonder why they were waxy, but he would turn them. Instead of actually taking them off and washing them, he would go to the trouble of turning them around because he was on his own and only slept on one side of the bed. He'd be like, oh, no, then I turn them around and I can get another 6 months out of them that way. And
smart.
I just ignore the waxy side.
Wow.
It's like, this is going to sound terrible, but it's like when you're on a trip and you just turn the underwear inside out.
Yeah, oh, we've all done that.
Oh,
there's no shame. No shame in that at all.
Back to front, why not?
Yeah, exactly.
I had a bra that saw me through an entire summer of interrailing. I don't even want to know the microbes that were living in that by the end of the trip. But yeah, no, and washing your knickers out in the sink and then drying them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, with a bit of washing up liquid as well.
Yeah.
And the
rubbing the gusset.
Amanda's doing the gusset rubbing technique. This has taken us into an area that I didn't think we were going to go down, but I'm quite happy to.
Mm.
In fact, and I tell you what, it reminded me of something that I was going to talk to you about, Evelyn, which is that although I have not been lucky enough to see you work, I only hear brilliant things about you, and particularly from my friend Viv, who I respect and love very
much. Yeah, Viv Graskov.
She's brilliant. commitment. And she said, you are one of the funniest people that she's ever seen. And she says, the commitment to the use of the word vagina is something that she can only marvel at and admire. So, and I don't think we use the word vagina quite enough.
We need to use it more. I actually tweeted when I tweeted, can we say vagina on Foo Bar Radio?
Tweet, yes.
And people raged. They were like, of course you can.
Say nothing but.
Push the boundaries a bit more. But yes, I do. I do have a bit whole spiel about how I talk about my vagina. A lot on the stage.
My vagina. I like the way you say it.
Because it doesn't get enough attention. So I need to direct focus there.
That's the only airing some vaginas get these days.
Exactly.
How I feel.
But it's come to, because that's the thing that people remember most about me and my stand-up. So not too long, I think 2 weeks ago, I was on the night bus and I was on my way back. And this couple were standing in front of me, and we stopped at a stop, and all of a sudden, they just turn around, look at me, shout vagina, and then just run off.
And well, thank God it was you. I mean, you know, exactly. Anyone else would have been taken aback, I would imagine. And
I was
did
like,
you
yep.
shout, thank you,
I,
that's me, vagina. Yeah. Thanks, guys. That's very
yes.
cool. That is the kind of public interaction that you want. That
exactly.
Is awesome. Because I remember when I started doing comedy, there was a very much a sort of the sort of feeling was, oh, women shouldn't talk about vaginas and periods and all of that business. And it is quite nice that I think there's a new generation of comedy where we're kind of going, do you know what, we're probably going to talk about our vaginas. Thanks very much.
Yeah.
Probably quite a lot.
Probably only.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, that's all good. I it's a funny old one, though, isn't it? Because you do... you see the squirm, and you see the kind of, oh,
yeah,
oh.
Exactly,
oh,
yeah, exactly.
Are we going there? Okay, fine. And then the embrace, then the love of vagina.
Yeah, then it comes back. It seems to be the thing that gets me through.
Did you talk about your vagina in Sweden, or is this a since you arrived here?
I did. I did one bit. I have one bit that I've translated. That's just a one-liner, really. No, did I? No, I didn't, maybe.
Ah.
I actually didn't. I came up with that in England.
Okay.
I think since coming to England, I've been more promiscuous with talking about my vagina.
Vagina chat has come into its own.
Yeah.
Well, see, I wonder whether, because mainland Europe, now, this is a theory that I'm going to throw at you, Evelyn, and you can bat it away and I will not be offended. But having done, now, I've only really, let me think where I've done. Holland mainly, where I have done sort of quite a few gigs in Holland, actually, and the standard of English, similar to the Scandinavian countries, very, very good, and big appetite for comedy, and British comedy particularly, you know, a lot of people have seen stuff on telly, so you get a really good audience in Holland, and they come along, and after the show, you have incredible chats with people, and they're very knowledgeable, very informed. Their English is brilliant. They have insightful, witty, wise things to say about your comedy, which I, without wishing to sound like a traitor to my own nation, do not find so much to be the case over here. But I also think there is just a bit more of a relaxed attitude about, like, you will get a laugh in Britain talking about your vagina.
Yeah.
Because it's that kind of, oh, I can't believe you just said that.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm not sure. Like, I remember doing a gig with the legendary Daniel Kitson in Holland. And there was a row, the front row, there were some very attractive women. And he was chatting to them. And, you know, as you do during a gig and, you know, finding out a bit about them. And he said also, you know, in some way the subject of relationships came up. And two of these women went, oh, we're lesbians, we're a couple. In fact, they didn't say we're lesbians, they said, oh, we're a couple. And this blew Daniel Kitson's tiny British mind. So it was so hilarious to watch, because he kind of, like, you know, and he stutters, you know, that's his part of his thing. And he couldn't speak, like, for about 5 minutes. He just completely lost his shit. just going, you're lesbians. And it was just about, and they were so, and it was so funny because the Dutch audience kind of found it funny that this repressed Englishman was having such a hard time with it. But eventually they were kind of like, Jesus, this is really a big deal for you, isn't it? This is kind of a big thing. And I wonder if we are, do you find we are more repressed and giggly and, you know, prudish?
I that's why I fit in so well here. but definitely in Sweden, I remember this one time, it was so awkward because I'm from a part of Gothenburg, which is sort of where all of the immigrants live. Mm-hmm. Yep. And so the kids of immigrants are a bit more uptight when it comes to sexuality and stuff. Mm-hmm. But our teachers in school were Swedish. So I remember this one time when we went to a bathhouse or a swimming house. Yeah. And our teacher was pretty much fully naked walking around.
They do.
In the showers. And we were so, or in the fitting rooms, coming up to talk to us even. And we were amazed and felt so uncomfortable. So,
oh my God, I'm now picturing all of my teachers naked.
Well, when I was 8 and went on a school trip and had to, in the dormitory that we're in, one of our teachers was in there and she got fully naked when she got ready for bed. And we were all really trying not to laugh. I mean, we were all, we were about 8 and she was, and she reprimanded us. She was like, what's, you know, it's like, well, you're our teacher and you're actually, I can see your vagina.
I mean, it's perfectly natural, but I mean, it's even weird seeing your PE teacher wearing a dress on parents' evening.
Yeah, just seeing them outside of.
It's Miss Hartnell in the street. That's amazing. But yeah, the idea of, yeah, I mean, the public nudity, because a couple of years ago at the Edinburgh Festival, I enrolled in a gym, and this woman who was, it turns out, it transpires, she was Scandinavian. We were in the Bannatyne's gym in Edinburgh. And I mean, Edinburgh people, of all the British, Edinburgh people are even more uptight than anywhere else.
Really?
And we were all swimming along, and this woman got out of the swimming pool, and you know they have the showers at the side, and she removed her swimming costume and soaped herself in the pool. She soaked fully. She was not mucking about. She was lathering up, and the entire pool. I was there with my friend Wendy, and we were like, oh my God, that's amazing. And so, and like everyone was looking, and then eventually, and so then we were in the changing room with her, and we were like, should we say anything? We went, oh, you're very brave. And she was like, oh, well, you know, in my country it's completely normal. Yeah. And we were like, it's not here.
So learn. Yeah. You have to learn.
Although I don't think anyone minded, you know. I think we need a bit more of that. I do, because I do still find it funny, like at comedy clubs, where the idea of someone being gay in 2015 can still be, oh, that's hilarious, like when a compere suggests that two men are a couple.
Right.
It's so amazing, isn't it? You just go, why is that still a thing?
That was the thing that surprised me the most when coming here, because Sweden is, as you say, this this haven of
nudity
and progression.
Yeah.
But it was very, if you make a comment about homosexuality or someone being maybe camp, it gets left. But in Sweden, that would be just, it would be a bit, you would think that was a bit hackish, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. You would think, as any right-thinking person would, it's 2015. Have we not moved on? But no, apparently we haven't. It's a source of great shame. Great shame. What about, and this, I don't know, I'm not going to...
ask it, Lucy.
Oh, I can't.
You're kind of halfway done.
No, because I was going to say, what about being a woman and you walk on stage in Sweden? Do you get any sort of any reluctance towards female comedians? Or
I would say there's a debate, definitely, but I never felt more aware of being a woman until I came to Britain. But even in Sweden, because I guess this has happened to you too, where people come up after shows and, oh, I don't usually like women, but
God, they do that in
you
Sweden.
Were so funny.
Even in Sweden.
Yeah, it's happened a few times in Sweden. But it's so, I think it's a, sexism in comedy is just a reflection of sexism in society. Yeah. So I would say Sweden is very progressive, but also it's more, it's, the industry isn't, I've always been received with open arms from people in the industry and here as well. Yeah. But it's more people who come as audiences that might have some comments afterwards that you find.
I suppose it is, you just go, well, if people never go to live comedy, then they sort of, I mean, I have actually seen an audience member go up to a black comedian and say, oh, it's lovely to see one of you doing this. Which made us all laugh, luckily, as we all slightly clenched our buttocks. But, it was a funny one. Now, listen, I while we were talking, I am a doodler, and I've just doodled what I can only describe as a picture of my vagina, which I think we should tweet.
Because I thought it was a flower.
I thought it was a dandelion.
It's so sort of Georgia O'Keeffe like style. dandelion.
It's like if you blow clock, your if you, vagina, did wonderful. Seeds come off? Can you, you do the clock with you your find vagina? Out what time 1 o'clock? It is.
Yes. So during the next song, we're going to blow my vagina and see what time it is.
I'll doodle mine too.
And you do, we'll do doodles of our vaginas. We can put those on. And I think we've used the word vagina quite a lot now. I think I'm happy with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm happy with our Swedish vagina chant. Thanks. Yes. Good. Do we have another record? Yes. Are you happy with that? What would you like to play now,
Amanda?
We're
going to play from the album of the week, Dusty Springfield, I Can't Make It Alone.
Oh, this is a lovely song. I Can't Make It Alone.
Lucy Porter on FUBAR Radio.
Oh, we've only had a tweet. We've only had a live tweet from Queen Bee, who is one of our live listeners, to say, my mum was aghast. This is on the subject of disappointing our mothers, which we've been talking about. My mum was aghast to learn that I spent the night sleeping in the park with a load of lads. Brackets was 15. That's a bad one. That is. Oh, do you know, that reminds me of, oh, also, Harmonious Shrimp. Hello. My mother was horrified when I got my tongue pierced. As she might well be, and no child of mine. Thank you very much, Harmonious Shrimp. My mum, okay, here's the way that I disappointed my mother. About when I was about 15, about a similar age to Queen Bee with her sleeping in the park, I organised a New Year's Eve party at my house. And I, you know that way when you're a teenager where you just think everything will be fine. Everything will be fine. And I had invited some girlfriends of mine and then a few boys were coming, and I told my mum and dad this. I said there's going to be about like five or six girls and then some of them might be boys, and my mum said, yeah, but of course, you know, the boys will go, won't they, you know, the girls can stay over but the boys will go. And I knew the boys were not going to go, that they were expecting to stay over on New Year's Eve, and I somehow thought, well, I'm sure it'll be fine, I'm sure it'll be absolutely fine. And cut to one in the morning, my mum, who is, my mum and dad are, you know, Catholics, and also, as I now appreciate, they had these other girls in their care with the trust of their parents, and there were these, you know, teenage boys lurking around, refusing to go home. And so my mum sat in the room with us all night on New Year's, seeing in New Year's Day with all of us. And, you know, people kept trying to sneak out and go and snog in the back garden. Even though it was New Year's Eve and freezing, people would go and try and snog, and my mum would go and track them down and then run back to the room we were in to try and stop us snogging. And I didn't know. That poor woman, how she put up with it, I have no idea. So, yeah. It was all about boys and snogging at that age. It's terrible behaviour.
Were you angry with her though? For
yeah, completely irrationally. Yeah. I was like, yeah, how dare you ruin our evening like this, you complete witch. And I did have my ears pierced twice. So similarly to our tweet, I had, and that wasn't, she didn't want me to have my ears pierced. I had it done twice, and the universe wreaked its revenge because I was allergic to earrings and wept pus for a long time, and now cannot wear earrings and have holes. holes in my ears to remind me how much I have disappointed my mum. It's like I've got stigmata there, just to occasionally my ears will weep to reflect the weeping of my mother. So there you go. Any piercings? Anyone pierced?
Pierced
vagina would be good.
Tweet in
tweet
with the
in.
Photo. My mom took me to pierce my ears, actually.
At what age?
I think I was 4. And no, I must have been, yeah, I was 6 because my cousin, who's 4 years younger, was 1.
Oh, so I had a double piercing with her, did you?
Yeah, and yeah. She was crying. She was the first one to go up. So I was a chicken. Send the baby. And she was crying so bad.
Well, it does hurt.
That it scared me. Yeah. But it was, I don't think it was my mother's idea. I think it was her younger sister's. My younger aunt, sort of the cool aunt. So she was like, oh, I'm going to pierce my 1-year-old daughter. What are you going to do? Challenged my mum.
Well, I better get my daughter pierced. I better inflict this on my own child just so I don't look not cool. Oh, wow. And do you still wear earrings?
I don't wear earrings, actually. Yeah. But I have the holes and I touch them occasionally to make sure they're still there. And I know that whenever I do put in an earring, which is maybe once every 2 years, I go through a little slither of skin over.
Yeah.
So it's like getting pierced all over again.
Yeah, just keep doing that pain to yourself. I had to wear earrings for a TV show that I did I was acting as someone who wore earrings. It was a very challenging part. It was a very difficult part for me, the kind of person who'd wear earrings. And and that they had to eventually, because my ears got so red and angry.
Oh.
And I had to eventually, my character decided she was going to stop wearing earrings about halfway through the
film. Why don't they just give you clip-on earrings?
I know. We all learned something that day on that production. The good thing is, though, actually, I have got getting a tattoo to hold back. I've never had a tattoo. And my mum and dad would be so upset and appalled and furious if I did. That I've got that. Even now in my early 40s, I still have something that I've got in reserve. If they ever really, really piss me off, I'll be able to get a prominent tattoo. That would be brilliant.
Because that's what my father, he said 2 things to me when I was growing up. Never start smoking and never get a tattoo. That would upset him. And then everything else was fine. But he would be very upset if I got a tattoo.
Oh, it's nice to know
smoking.
We've still got somewhere to go, isn't it? That we can, yes. I'm going to say to my children, I'm going to have a massive list, like a sort of 2 inches deep folder of things that they're not allowed to do, so that they'll at least then they can tick off the sort of milder ones, and then move on to. In fact, I wouldn't mind a tattoo. Wouldn't mind piercings.
Where would you get the tattoo?
Across your chest.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be somewhere that prominent, hasn't it? Although somewhere like my wrist, because actually I don't mind. I quite like the look of wrist tattoos, but it would completely appall my parents. So, yeah, I think I'd go for the wrist.
It would give you street cred.
I'd go for Catholics are twats on my wrist. that would be a way to ensure that I never see my parents again, which I don't want to do because I love them very much. Good. Anyway, now listen, I should talk about our record of the week. I've just realised we have been playing songs from it and I have not discussed it at all. Dusty in Memphis. Now, so last week, Evelyn, we had Live Through This by Hole. So we've gone for a bit of a gear change to Dusty in Memphis. Now, and the reason I picked this is I love Dusty Springfield, A. And this was, they re-released this. In about, I think, the early 90s in the UK, and it hadn't done very well. This album, Dusty in Memphis, she recorded it in 1968, released it in 69. And so Dusty Springfield had been like a great British pop star, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, had a few hits, and then she decided in 68 to go to Memphis. She wanted to emulate the soul singers, the black soul singers that she loved, and she wanted to do a record with Atlantic Records because she loved Aretha Franklin, and Aretha was her idol and she was on Atlantic Records. So she went to Memphis and recorded this like incredible soul songs with incredible session musicians and the best producers, with Arif Mardin and Jerry Wexler, and Tom Dowd from Atlantic. And what I love about Dusty Springfield is she was a true eccentric, and she hated recording, and she was such a perfectionist that she, although this album is called Dusty in Memphis, she actually ended up re-recording most of the vocals in New York afterwards because she was so insecure about her performance and she felt like she hadn't done it justice. And the producers said it was like the biggest nightmare that she wouldn't approve anything. Like she would sing it and she'd go, no, I'm going to do it again. So it was an album that was a nightmare to produce, and it only sold 100,000 copies when it was released. It was a complete flop. But it's come to be one of the classic albums of all time, and it's always on, you know, list of top 100 albums and stuff. So it just goes to show that a bit of failure yeah. never hurts. Sometimes the things you do at the time aren't appreciated, but they come on to be recognised. And also just what a sort of very difficult and challenging life she had. She had, you know, struggles with drugs and drink, and she was a lesbian, but she kind of was never properly out, and she had very difficult, troubled relationships. But created what I think is one of the most beautiful albums in the world. Mm. So, and also, as we discovered, one of those albums where all the songs are really short. This entire album lasts about 20 minutes because everything is less than 3 minutes, and a lot of them aren't. A lot of them don't even make it to two. So it's a beautiful record, and I love Dusty Springfield. And also, she was her career was revived by the Pet Shop Boys, who I loved and love and adore. And so she's sort of, again, something I find quite inspiring in other people's careers is when they have a bit of time in the wilderness, and then everything turns out all right in the end. Because I feel I'm very much in my wilderness years. Have been my entire career, really. But I'm sure the good times are just around the corner.
The kids have come along.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're like, ah.
Exactly. That's, this is my fallow period. So we're going to have some more from that album in a bit. But shall we have... Now, Evelyn, have you chosen us
yes,
a song?
I have, actually.
Do we have that queued up,
we
Amanda?
We do, yep.
Because I would like to hear it. What have you chosen for us?
I've chosen a Slater Kinney song. And it's off of their new album because they've just reunited.
Yes, indeed. I've been playing some London Day. Well, probably all over the country, but I saw they were in London because all my friends went and I was really jealous.
And me too.
Yeah,
I didn't get a ticket. Too late to get a ticket.
Let's listen to what we could have won.
A New Wave by Slater Kinney.
Show on FUBAR Radio.
Still too cheerful. I've got a mouthful of Smarties. That was good. We've cracked open the Pimms for the second hour of the show. Evelyn is bravely and gamely trying some first experience of Pimms, or you've had those a few times?
I've had one once before.
Yeah.
And it's very fruity and
it
nice.
Is. This one's just out of a can. You probably had it with all the accoutrements. Before.
Yeah, with the fancy stuff.
Thank you for picking Slater Kinney. That's really, really good. Do you know, I was going to tell you my Slater Kinney story?
Yes.
I didn't get to see them this time, but I did see them. And I'm trying to remember what year it was. It was at a festival called All Tomorrow's Parties, which must have been back in, the early part of this millennium. And it was amazing because they were curating. So every day of the festival was curated by a different act. So Dinosaur Jr. did the first day.
Oh, yeah.
And The Shine did the last day. And then Slater Kinney curated the Saturday of this festival. And they were incredible. And before them, for their support act, they had chosen to bring over David Cross, the brilliant, brilliant American comedian who you will all know from Arrested Development and
Mr. Show.
Anyway, and I was beyond excited about this, you know, seeing David Cross live, and I had one of his albums. I was like, it's going to be amazing, Slater Kinney and David Cross. And the crowd at this music festival, of course, because I forget that not everyone is into comedy, and certainly at that point it wasn't quite as big as it is now even, and they did not give David Cross a chance, and I got absolutely furious. I'm a bit school marmish anyway at the best of times, and David Cross came on and no one was listening to him, no one was paying any attention. They were all a bit like, what is this, it's not music, and I went around telling people off and listen to him, he's amazing, shut up, he's brilliant. And he was brilliant, but what he did, which is, as another comedian, Evelyn, you will really appreciate this, is he dealt with an unplayable, I mean, it was a completely unplayable gig. There was no way that this audience were going to listen to him. They weren't going to shut up. They were all furious. They were like, we want Slay Skinny, we don't want you. And he dealt with it with such brilliant fury. you know, where someone, you know, and I was trying to think, how would I deal with that? Because, I mean, I have dealt with situations similar, but, you know, you think, I never feel I've dealt with it as brilliantly as he did, because he was just furious and hilarious. And those of us who were listening absolutely loved it. But, yeah, but he was, and then Slay Skinny were amazing. So, you know,
yeah.
The whole thing turned out very nicely in the end. That's so good.
Because I've seen the, have you seen the video clip of Bill Burr on YouTube where he does the same thing, basically? He comes out to a stage, I don't know where it is, but he is booed. The audience is just, they're drunk and they're just booing him and heckling and everything. Mm. And he stays, he's supposed to do 10 or 20, and he stays for the whole time.
Good for him.
Just yelling.
I don't want me to be here, but I'm going to stay.
Exactly.
I love
and
that.
Does his time.
If you're going to go down, go down in flames.
Yeah.
Because that's, it's quite a big thing in America. They do have comics opening for bands quite a lot.
Yeah.
And it seems to me like the most foolhardy enterprise, you know, because I had a friend when I used to do comedy in Manchester when I first started out, and there was a guy called Bob Dillinger who was a very nice, quite gentle guitar act, and he did lovely songs, you know, sort of topical songs, and but a very gentle soul, and he opened for Gloria Estefan at like this massive arena in Manchester, and we were all kind of going, this seems like an odd match. But I think, like, Gloria Estefan's people had kind of gone, well, you know, we have comedians opening, and I guess in the States she's probably got some, you know, there's some Hispanic comedian who's like that, and it was brilliant. And we sort of, and we all said to him, how did that go? And he said, Not brilliantly.
Wasn't my best.
Not amazing.
But also, is Gloria Estefan the kind of musical act who would have a comedian open for you?
You don't go, if I were going to see Gloria Estefan, I wouldn't think, oh, I hope she's got some topical, whimsical comedy to get me in the mood for duck, 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 duck to be.
That is so funny.
But yeah, it's a really bizarre thing. I mean, I have done, have you done music festivals? Have you ever done any of those?
I've done Latitude, yeah.
Because at least, even like there, at least you're on a comedy stage with other terms rather than sort of thrown to the walls. I did once do a kind of Battle of the Bands competition thing where, but I was sort of emceeing it, so it was okay. I could just sort of, you know, not have to do anything. But, oh dear, no. That's
go off.
Anyway, thank you for reminding me of that with the Slater Kinney.
You're welcome.
The Slater Kinney track.
Yeah.
Now, there was another news story from the week that I wanted to discuss, and the news story is that the wonderful Sue Perkins, and I will tell you now that there are very few people in the world of show business or the world of the world that I have more affection and respect for than Sue Perkins. I love her, and she got terrible abuse on Twitter for not for wanting to present Top Gear, but for somebody making up a story that she was going to present Top Gear. She had nothing. I love this, you know, where she had no input in this at all. No, at no point did she say, I'd like to present Top Gear. What do you think about that, guys? Why not tweet me and tell me what that's about? And just got horrific abuse for because somebody had suggested that she might be the next presenter of motoring programme Top Gear after the disgrace of Jeremy Clarkson. And it made me think, actually, I would like to present Top Gear. Mm. And I'm going to throw it out there now, and I'm prepared to take the abuse as it comes, because I think I would be a very good presenter for Top Gear, and I will tell you for why. Because I think all the people, and men and women, it wasn't just men, there were women as well, who were appalled at the idea of Sue Perkins taking over on Top Gear. And it did seem to be largely because she was a woman. I'm not sure if being a lesbian was even worse, or whether that ameliorated it slightly, or what the. But there was general disgust, and I think I would be a good replacement for Jeremy Clarkson because I am a woman, which they would not like. But I am a very bad driver. And I think this is the way around it, because I think all of these people who are like, oh, you can't have a woman presenting a motor show, I would be confirming their stereotypes about female drivers. Yeah.
And each episode would be very exciting.
Exactly. Who knows whether any of those cars would make it through to the end of the show. So I'm humbly putting my bid in to say, because I, not only do I mean, I am a terrible driver and I will admit this, and it isn't, I feel weird about saying it because I do always feel like I'm a slight traitor to my gender because, you know, the stereotype is that women can't drive, but it is nothing, I believe, to do with my gender or my sex that I cannot drive. It's pure, and because my sister, there is a control in this experiment. My sister is a brilliant driver, and we are from the same genetic stock, and we are very much both women. But and she can parallel park. She can do all of the stuff. I am utterly, utterly shit at driving to the extent that I've often thought if people buy a ticket to my show, and I will throw this out here. I'm on tour at the moment. If you go to my website, you can find my dates. If you buy a ticket for my show, what I would advise you to do is turn up to the venue about an hour before showtime. Get a drink, station yourself in the car park, and watch me attempting to park my car, because it will be funny. And I say that, I mean, I think the show is quite entertaining, but me attempting to park is funnier than anything I've ever managed to do on stage. And I often have, it's like I have a degree of a sort of lack of spatial awareness that I think is bordering on some kind of syndrome or, you know, condition. It's not normal. And I have been driving the current car that we have, which is, it was new to us about three and a half, four years ago. And still have absolutely no idea how big that car is, and cannot for the life of me, every time I park it, anyway, even in our own driveway, I have to get out and look at the front of the car and see where it is in relation to walls, hedges and everything. And it's beyond, I mean, I have had to have people park cars for me on numerous occasions. I've had to get to venues, go in and say, listen, I'm terribly sorry, could you come out and park my car, because I have spent the last half hour getting really sweaty and annoyed. And
how
trying to park.
Disappointed That's your really mother funny. Must be.
Oh,
about
isn't
this.
She must be. Although, no, actually, I think she quite likes, I think she'd think it's quite ladylike.
Oh, right.
Next time. I think we're okay. I think, you know, this is why I think I'd be a good presenter for Saturday, because I think a lot of people go, oh, that's all right. Oh, bless. You know, she is a typical woman who cannot drive, but I don't think I'm a typical woman. I think I am. There's something very badly wrong with me. But I also have no interest in any car that was made after about 1985, which I think would be another sterling asset on a show about contemporary cars. I think that would be a brilliant, just to watch. Basically, since the Ford Capri, there has been nothing that's excited me in the world of cars. Every week I would basically be on saying, why don't you just get an old Karmann Ghia or a Ford Corsair or something pretty and old and make it new? And that's, don't buy one of the horrible new cars, because I think new cars are horrible.
Auntie Lucy.
Yeah, yeah. Nice Auntie Lucy.
Driving Miss Lucy.
That would be, I could just have a driver. This is a really good idea. I present the show without having to drive a car.
And then you interview the driver about what they think.
Yeah, exactly. How was that? Is that a good car? Did you like that? Because I didn't. I thought we went a bit close to the curb a few times. I did once, actually. I did appear on a programme called Stars in Fast Cars. And the title of that programme was misleading on a number of counts. Firstly, there were some genuine stars there, Carol Smiley, John Fashney, there were people there, but there was me and a few other people no one had ever heard of. And the fast cars bit was a slight misnomer in my case, because I drove around, it was Throxton, I think it was called, the racetrack. And I drove around very carefully. I was very careful in the fast car. And yes, it was, oh dear, that was a very long day in a boiler suit that I'll never get back. So, have you got any interest in presenting Top Gear, Evelyn? Are you inclined?
Top Gear, I like the idea of bad drivers presenting Top Gear. That was very good.
Are you, you don't drive in this country, do you?
I don't drive here, no, but I drive in Sweden, but I've heard that I drive like a thief. Like someone who's just stolen a car.
Great. Well, you're very much the opposite to me. I'm very careful. I sit at junctions for days sometimes. So between us, we could drive badly in a variety of different ways. And also, yeah, you could drive on the wrong side of the road. That's always fun. That's always thrilling.
That's very good. Because I guess I'm a bad driver because I don't believe I'm a bad driver. But people tell me that I am.
It's nice that other people are very prepared to tell you about your driving.
Exactly.
Although nobody ever thinks they're a bad driver. This is why I, as much as I don't want to admit it because I'm a woman and I feel it does us all a disservice, on the other hand, I think it is good to admit because I think nobody ever admits that they're not confident about driving. It's like sex, you know, people don't ever kind of, in fact, no, sex, more people, I think, would admit that they're not very good at sex than would admit that they're not very good at driving. I think it's a really cultural, again, maybe it's British, I don't know, or maybe it's a global thing, but nobody ever wants to say, oh, actually, I'm not very good at driving. Mm.
Yeah, nobody wants to be. Is it because it takes away your independence, in a way?
Yes.
You have to wait for your mother to come and pick you up.
Not, well, also, I suppose I shouldn't really be admitting it because if they do ever decide to change your insurance on the basis of your own assessment of your driving skills, I would be absolutely screwed because I should be paying a lot more. I should be paying a lot more than other people. I don't. All of this stuff about, oh, women get lower. Generally, I mean, that is the thing as well, isn't it? All of this stuff about, oh, you know, women don't know about driving, super, and shouldn't be presenting a driving show, she's a woman. You know, I mean, statistically, how much more do we need to sort of be, have it proved to us that women are safer, better drivers? You know, women get, or used to get, lower insurance. I think now it's we can't anymore because of human rights.
That's
or something,
right, yeah, because it's got that, doesn't it?
You know, like European human
equality.
Rights.
Exactly.
It's
bloody
got
equality. But yeah, it's
I would say the same thing. I'm not a bad driver because I'm a woman. I'm a bad driver because I'm Chinese.
Good. As long as it's racism and not sexism,
exactly.
I'm perfectly comfortable with that.
I'll do that intersectionality.
Yeah, well, I, you know, went to Italy and everyone was doing the Italians are such terrible drivers, and all of that shtick about, oh God, Italian drivers, they're the worst. And I was driving around going, these people seem exemplary to me. I don't see anything wrong with it. The way they drive is confident and, you know, strong.
And they make up their own rules.
Yeah.
I think that's the key. They're actually very good drivers. They just don't give a damn about, like, the communal rules.
They
drive a bit how they want.
Exactly, yeah. They've got the independence and wherewithal to do it properly. So yeah, that was, so yeah, if anyone wants to tweet me and abuse me for having the audacity to say I'm going to present, I mean, I'm not really going to present Top Gear. I should make that point.
I actually know Zayn Malik, who just left One Direction, should go and present
Top
Gear.
That's a great idea.
Because he needs a job.
And he presumably likes... Does he like cars, or have you just... He probably does.
Yeah. He's ridden in a lot of them, I think. Yes. He's been driven around in them.
Was he one of the ones who they thought might be taking drugs?
Oh, I'm not sure, actually.
I mean, let's not go there, because it's probably libelous. But, anyway, but I'm sure... Yeah. Oh, that's nice. I would... I think what he really needs is a spell out of the limelight, isn't it?
Mm.
I think what he needs to do is...
He could be Stig, because you don't know who.
Great,
you don't know who he is,
Amanda.
Do you?
You're a genius.
There we go.
Well, he could be the guy who. Yeah, he's the Stig who drives me around. So he is the anonymous driver in a gimp suit who takes me.
How you prefer to be driven around?
That's kind of what Stig is, isn't it? It's basically a sort of gimp suit.
Yeah.
So Zayn Malik in a gimp suit and me presenting Top Gear together.
I think this is, I think we should pitch this.
With Evelyn Mock doing the crazy Swedish Chinese driving school thing. Okay, good.
Today we learned to parallel park.
We never did that on my test, you see. I'm so old that we never. My driving test was basically just get in the car, try not to crash it. I had a friend who, on her way out of the test centre, drove into another car as someone was opening the door and took the door off. Like, she failed, but that was pretty much, I mean, unlike my diving paddy and my grade one guitar, I actually passed my driving test. No, not the first time, because I was terrible, but the second time I was still terrible. The first time I had to do reversing around a corner and there were cones in the road and I hit a couple of them. you know, which I think was fine. But yeah, the second time, which I really shouldn't have passed, I really shouldn't. I should really have to do it again. But I'll do my test again. There we go.
I forgot to I forgot to put in the the handbrake when I parked, so the car still.
You didn't want your test to end. You were just carrying. I think driving test examiner must be a very interesting and stressful job. I'd never thought about it before today, but I wonder if my driving test examiner knows what he unleashed on the world. Who knows? Can we play the interview that I recorded with Carly Paradis?
Certainly.
Is that going to be doable? Yeah. I'll set this up for you. So Carly Paradis is a songwriter, a composer, and most recently has been doing soundtracks for television and film. And she is absolutely brilliant. And so I did an interview with her and talked to her about her career and the people who've inspired her and who she finds inspiring. I am here with Carly Paradis, who is an excellent film and television composer. And is Canadian.
Yes, I am.
Indeed. But based in London now.
Yes.
And I was going to ask you to name a female composer who has inspired you.
Okay, well, there is a wonderful, brilliant composer named Jenny Musket, who's from London, actually. And when I first got to the UK, she was a great inspiration and very supportive and helpful. And has become a good friend. She did the theme tune to MI5, and she's done, you know, a ton of documentaries and won an Emmy Award and BAFTA nominated. So yeah, I think she was a special woman in the field that I was able to connect with.
And now you are doing incredible stuff, and you have been doing Line of Duty, which we all love.
Oh,
and also an upcoming adaptation of Lady Chatterley's Lover, the BBC, Saucy. I like the fact you did a... Did you have to do lots of saucy music for that?
It's a period drama, but there's some saucy spots for sure that I had to really think about.
I sort of hope you just used old Carry On film music and a little swanny whistle. And so your career is going brilliantly. And I wondered if there was anyone else you wanted to give a shout out to, newer up and coming composers that you think we should look out for.
Yeah, definitely. There's a really cool guitarist actually named Charlotte Hatherley, and she played in the band Ash.
Love the great live band.
Yeah.
Amazing Northern Irish outfit.
Oh yeah, amazing. And she's also played in some other really great bands as well. And she's there's actually a connection with, because I worked on the film Moon, with Duncan
Jones is
directed.
Amazing film.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
Yeah, it was wonderful. Got to work with Clint Mansell, who I work with. I think the guy who did all the design and graphics for that, he did a short film. She's just recently scored that. So she's starting to get into the film scoring world. So, and I just saw her at South Bank, and she did a live performance of the score. So yeah, keep an eye out for Charlotte Hatherley.
Charlotte Hatherley. And Clint Mansell there, you mentioned, would he be your token man who you feel you owe a debt of gratitude to?
Oh yeah, big time. He's one of my top all-time composers. Awesome guy. And you know, coming from a band, Pop Will Eat Itself, you know, and then to do all of Darren Aronofsky's film, like Requiem for a Dream, Black Swan, like his music is just out of this world. And he's been such an inspiration and friend and help to me. Very lucky.
Oh gosh, I mean, I remember seeing Pop Will Eat Itself at the World's End pub in Camden in the 1990s. Delighted that he's broken out of the beer and sweat-soaked indie scene such amazing, tremendous heights.
Did he have tape across his face and dreadlocks?
Yeah. He looked like he smelled. Does he smell?
No, he's completely different now. He's like a man.
That's such good news. Well, thanks very much, Carly Paradis.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Does he smell? I don't know. Also, I've noticed what I have a tendency to do is just bang on about gigs I've been to. This is like the sort of the memories of an old lady who used to be on the indie scene. I don't get out much anymore, you know. It's been a while since I've been to a live show. But anyway, we're going to hear one of Carly's tracks at the end of the show, so hang around for that, and we're going to play out with it. But before that, now, Evelyn Mock, we were talking earlier on about women in space. It's a nice, what you've done there is brought a theme.
Yeah.
Theme to the show, which I enjoy. We're not just picking a woman, but picking some women who have something in common. So tell us more about Women in Space.
Women in Space. I'm very fond of Sally Ride, because she being the first sort of American woman to go up into space, she got very interesting questions because of her gender. She, some people asked her if going into space at a press conference, if going into space would affect her reproductive organs.
Wow.
And then also if if at work, if she found it tough or something wasn't going her way, if she would have a little cry.
Nice.
At her desk.
Yes.
So that's kind of fun. And I thought a quote that she, that I quite like, that she's known for. It's a little long, but I will read it.
Please do. You have a lovely voice.
Thank you. Suppose you came across a woman lying on the street with an elephant sitting on her chest. You noticed she is short of breath. Shortness of breath can be a symptom of heart problems. In her case, the much more likely cause is the elephant on her chest. For a long time, society put obstacles in the way of women who wanted to enter the sciences. That is the elephant. Until the playing field has been leveled and lingering stereotypes are gone, you can't even ask the question. And I guess she's referring to how is it to be woman in science. And I feel, I guess you feel that too.
It's incredibly.
It relates to comedy.
It relates to almost every field endeavor.
Exactly,
where
yeah.
Women, well, in fact, and that reminded me of a story from last year, where again, Yelena Serova, the first Russian woman to go to the International Space Station, there's a clip of her getting visibly annoyed where they are asking, again, it's a press conference, despite being a flight engineer and the first Russian woman in space for 17 years, she is asked about makeup and how she will take care of her hair. When she's asked
in
about
space.
Her hair, Serova returns with a question of her own. Can I ask a question too? Aren't you interested in the hairstyles of my colleagues? And they also ask her about leaving her daughter behind and how that will affect their relationship. It is incredible, isn't it, that you sort of think, well, yes, a press conference, that your first thought would be, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll ask the woman about the woman's, yes, about hair and makeup. It is,
if it's overwhelming, if she just cries a little.
And when I always get there, because, you know, having children, and it's not people, the problem is people often are coming from a good place where they say, oh, is it hard for you leaving your children, like when I'm away at a gig or something? And of course it really is, but then it's also equally hard for the men who are on the bill with me. But they don't get asked. And you feel arsey when someone's asking you a really nice question. You know, it's not like hair and makeup or something. It's a genuinely kind of heartfelt, emotional question. But I sort of feel like, well, yeah, but it's difficult for anyone who has to go away to work, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, everyone makes those decisions and those sacrifices.
And
anyway.
it also feels like it could start with the questions, pretty much.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
One way is to kind of
exactly like the
rephrase the questions,
the sort of red carpet stuff where now women, and it only takes a few people, like, you know, recently Cate Blanchett and you know, people who just go, do you know what, actually I can't be asked to answer questions about my dress and my hair. And and Sarah Millican, the most brilliant thing, I don't know if you read her article about going to an awards ceremony,
yes.
Just being slagged off for what she was wearing.
Yeah.
And saying, well, look, I'm a comedian. I'm not a model. I'm not putting myself out there as someone who's interested in hair and clothes. And I think that's, as soon as someone does it, you go, God, yeah, of course. How have we all spent all these years being fine with this? You know, I mean, it's it is incredible. But well, thank you for sharing your space, ladies.
Thank you for.
She said immediately
listening.
Robbing them of the. I love the space. You know, the space ladies with their lovely hair. That's all very good. And I was going to ask you about your general plans, life. Career. I feel like we haven't really. It's been so much your show, and you haven't even. You should have had a sting. I feel this every. I'm going to get on this because every week it's the Lucy Parlour show, and it's like, well, it's not really. It's half. I think we should. Should we do a live sting for you? We'll do a
yeah,
live
sure.
sting for Evelyn Mock.
That'd be wonderful.
What would you like your name to rhyme with? Doc Rock Bock. Bock. I don't even know what a bock is.
Sock.
Sock. Okay, lovely. What kind of what musical style would you like your jingle to be in?
Reggae.
Reggae. Evelyn Mock. She wears a sock. I'm not an improviser, it turns out.
That was quite lovely.
Yeah, I could work on it. I really could. I could get there. Also, I wasn't quite sure how to do reggae.
Reggae. It's a tough one, isn't it?
with a backing track. Evelyn Mock wears a very nice sock. No, she's not wearing socks because it's hot. Yeah, it hasn't really worked out, has it? Let's be honest. We'll get the man who does the over-enthusiastic thing. Evelyn Mock! It's Evelyn Mock, ladies and gentlemen. Evelyn Mock.
Evelyn Mock.
So, because you have been doing... Now, you were doing a podcast with Sophie Hagen.
Yes, I was.
A brilliant comedian.
Lovely lady.
Yeah. Who I have worked with and enjoyed very much. Mm. And are you still doing that?
We aren't, actually.
Well, good. I'm glad I brought that up. Well, you can still download it. It's still there, isn't it? It's still there.
It's still there. It's still on iTunes somewhere. We tried... Here's the thing with me and Sophie, we have very good intentions, and we tried, we had one podcast where we just chatted, we did three episodes, and then we had another podcast called Funny for a Girl, where we chatted with lady comedians, and we did 10 episodes of that.
That's quite good, that's for comedians, that's quite a commitment, that's very good, I applaud you.
And then we stopped that and tried to resurrect the one where only us two were chatting. Mm-hmm. We just wanted to sleep in instead.
Who knew that comedians would lack commitment and focus? It's a shocker, isn't it? Would that have disappointed your mother, do you think, Evelyn?
My mother. I actually have a story about disappointing her where she came to see me in a swimming school thing when I went to swimming school, and I wanted to impress her so much. And I was so glad that she came that I just... At simultaneously as I was swimming, I was waving to her. But that meant that it affected my swimming. So
it would, yes.
I didn't swim too good. So afterwards she said, Why did you lag behind? So I think that disappointed
her. That's a heartbreaking
story. That really is.
Heartbreaking. That's trying to please and disappoint. At least all my disappointing stories have been things I was doing that were actively shit.
Yeah.
Whereas yours was actually trying to be... I love the poignancy of that. That's what... If anyone wants to tweet in or write it... We've probably got an email. Have we got an email?
That's probably
Lucy
why I'm...
Lucy@foobarradio.com.
Yeah. If you can match that kind of poignancy, that's what I'm looking for in stories, is not so much bad behaviour that's disappointed your mother, but desperately attempting to prize love from a parent. Could be your father, actually. Let's broaden it.
Probably most likely
or
your
anyone,
father.
Or a partner. Anyone you've ever tried to impress and found yourself failing miserably. That's the kind of dismal story that I enjoy. That's very good. But anyway, so the podcast that I very much enjoyed is No More. But only because you're very busy doing other things.
We are.
So tell me what you're up to.
Well, I washed my hair today.
Busy life.
Well,
you're off. In fact, for the people who are listening live, and we know there are some because you have been tweeting, if you can get yourselves to the Canonbury, you could see Evelyn Mock tonight, which I think would be
in Islington. Yes, yeah. It's
Islington, London. By the way, I have no idea where people are listening.
Preliminary stage time is 9:40. So if you guys want to come,
the Pims might have kicked in by then. I think you, me, and Amanda should all go drunk.
It'll be a very interesting show. Yeah. Well, I'm doing a 40-minute show for Edinburgh this year, and I'm previewing it next. A week.
What's it called? Does it have a title yet?
It's called Idiot.
Hey, I'm on your side already. Good. And what manifestations of idiocy will you be discussing in this show?
It's about finding a letter for myself as a child and realizing that I haven't achieved anything of what I wanted to.
Oh, wow. So you haven't just disappointed your mother, you've disappointed yourself. Yeah, that's even
my child
better.
Me.
You have disappointed your past self. Oh.
So it'll be me trying to figure out why, and also maybe if I could try to achieve something now.
Achieve some of those things that you're... How old were you when you wrote the letter?
It was 99, so I was... 12.
12. God,
11,
yeah.
12, yeah.
12-year-old. You're very harsh on your future self at that age, aren't you? That was about the age where I would have said... I remember having a conversation on the school playing field with one of my friends and saying, well, of course, yeah, you know, by the time I'm 30, I mean, obviously I'll be married, probably have a couple of kids, and then I'll be like back into my career.
As a lawyer slash movie star?
Yeah, yeah. I think by that stage of the lawyer thing, I already realised was a bit of a non-starter. But yeah, God, that's a very good subject area, because I'm sure a lot of people will be able to relate to having had those thoughts as a youth. And yeah. Where are you going to be doing that in Edinburgh?
In Edinburgh, I'm at the Counting House on the Free Fringe.
Oh, that's it.
So, yeah, I'm quite excited. In a tiny, tiny room called The Studio at 5 p.m.
5 p.m. being an idiot.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a good... I see, I'm trying to think of all the ways in which... Now I'm making it all about myself again, but yes, all the ways in which... I think generally, the competence or the lack of competence that I've shown in almost all areas of my life would have disappointed me. But I think, most specifically, I think it would have been that I kind of thought I'd understand what it was all about and I would have some sense of being a grown-up. I think it's that, isn't it?
Yeah.
You feel like
yeah.
you will be a grown-up and you will know what being a grown-up feels like.
Exactly, yeah. And then you realise that you wake up one day and you're 27 and you're in a bedsit. With no kitchen.
With unwashed sheets.
With unwashed sheets.
Oh, do you live on your own?
Yes, yes. I've been lucky enough to find a tiny, tiny bed sit, which is smaller than the studio, I must say.
Oh, yes.
But I have no kitchen.
Well, you don't need when you're a young girl about town.
True.
You can find people to give you scraps.
Eat some hummus.
I've given you some Smarties tonight and some pins.
And pins.
So we're on our way.
This will keep me for a week.
Is it illegal to rent a flat without a kitchen?
Oh, I have no idea.
I mean, I think in London now there's no sense.
I think it's anything goes, really.
God, it is. Well, you're lucky you're not sharing it. That is the kind of flat that, you know. I know I've got a friend whose 18-year-old son has just moved here to London. Sorry, we're recording this in London. I apologise for that. But this friend's 18-year-old has moved here and is sharing a room with three other people.
A room with three other people?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very... I did that. Me and Sophie actually shared a room when we moved here the first time. And it was me, her and a rat.
Oh, nice that you had some other company.
Exactly.
If one of you's out at a gig, then at least you know the rat will be there.
You had the rat.
I know, I look back on my... Because my sort of bedsit years in Elephant and Castle, you know, at the time I thought it was quite bleak, and now I realise that I was living in a paradise.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. You know, you just go, God, that to me seemed like, oh, well, this is pretty low, you know. I mean, but I had both a kitchen of sorts. I mean, you know, it was only a two-ring hob, but it was a kitchen. And a bathroom. The toilet didn't always work, but it existed. Yeah. You know,
my shower door is broken.
Yeah. So,
but I have a shower.
So do you know what? I like having these kind of discussions because it makes everyone who is not in London realise how very lucky they are not to be here. So that's all very good.
Apparently, I've heard that it's only in London that people live in flats and rest of England, people live in houses.
Mansions. Yes. You know Downton Abbey?
Yeah.
Right? That's
that's
where
England.
Everybody else lives. You've picked the one place where people live in. I know, it's crazy. But we don't want to lose you. Don't go back to Sweden, please.
Ooh, I will stay.
Please
okay.
stay. Thank you very much.
Lucy.
That'd be nice. Now, do we have any more? No, Amanda, I'm going to look at you. Do we have a bit of time before the...
We have 6 minutes.
Okay. Oh, my God. We've actually got age. Oh, do you know what? I've done that thing of actually winding up slightly prematurely. We can start a whole new thing.
Yeah, let's do a whole new thing.
Let's start a whole new thing. All right, perfect. Because what I was going to talk about was sport.
Mm.
Because having tackled driving, which I know nothing about, I thought, what could be better than moving on to sport? Because, I don't know if you're aware of this, Sophie, there is an institution in Britain... Sophie? Evelyn.
That's the most common thing that happens.
Yeah, 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 I know. We've been talking about her. It's like she's in the room.
Yeah.
So, Evelyn, we have been talking, or we have a thing in Britain which is called the University Boat Race.
Yes.
Which is where Oxford and Cambridge, as you may know, go head-to-head. And for last weekend, for the first time, the women's boat race was performed. Is that what you call it? Performed? Run? Contested?
Rowed
at the same time as the man's.
Sailed.
And it was a big thing because the women's boat race has kind of, it existed and then it stopped because there was no money for it for a while, and then they kind of, and because there is now a renewed focus on women in sport, I think they've decided, right, we're going to bring this back and we're going to run on it on the same day as the men's. Mm. They used to, and I think this is such a sweet touch, they used to, for the women's boat race, not actually allow the women to compete head to head.
So they would both.
Well, this is, my mother would very much approve, because yeah. competition is not ladylike. They would run the two teams, so the Oxford and the Cambridge team would both row the course, but separately, so that they weren't in direct competition, and then the judges would award marks for style as well as for speed.
Physical style or rowing style?
I don't know. I'm not entirely sure. I didn't go into that that deeply. But I thought it just really, it tickled me, the idea that you could, you know, sort of have women competing but not directly, because that would be bad. but yes, the angle I was thinking of with that is, because I do enjoy watching sport a bit more than I used to. I never had any interest in it as a younger person. But I quite enjoy watching sport. And in the same way that I'm going to be the new presenter of Top Gear, mm-hmm. I feel that I would quite like to do something to boost, mm-hmm. not necessarily women's sport, but just different sport. Mm-hmm. Because I think, it seems like, yes, football is, in this country, football is the dominant sport. But it seems quite arbitrary, because you go around the world and it's not like football is the only sport with kind of mass appeal. Because you go to America and they have their own American football, they have baseball. Mm. You go to Spain and they play this weird thing that's kind of like squash meets tennis against a wall, that nobody else plays, but they love it. And like Japan, they've got a world of kind of stuff, different, you know, sumo and all those sort of things. Also, they do like competitive long distance relay racing, which I was hearing about the other day, which sounds brilliant. It's like it's like a massive relay for thousands of miles. And that all sounds quite cool to me. And I do wonder whether the problem with sport in this country is that we are mm-hmm. so dominated by football and rugby and cricket mm. and those kind of
traditional
sports. I wonder if we could come up with something new, or I'm not entirely sure where I'm going with this, but I'd like to be Minister of Sport.
I had a terrible premise for a joke. Where I said that where I said to make sport more interesting for women, we could have different types of female sports. So it was also kind of, I was trying to be ironic, but I don't think it came through.
I often have that
problem. Where we would have female types of sports where women would have a competition where two women talk smack about a third woman behind her back.
Yeah.
And then the third woman comes in and she has to figure out what's going on.
Competitive bitching.
Competitive bitching.
Which I kind of say, yeah, that's the thing is, you sort of think of that and going, that's kind of because you're playing on the stereotypes about women and what we're good at, but then actually that will go down a bloody treat in front of an audience. What you've done there is you've exactly. inadvertently created a joke that people will take it completely face down.
Yeah,
this
exactly.
is amazing! I know. It's a difficult one, isn't it? Because you sort of think, well, it's maybe there is something about the nature of sport and testosterone and male aggression and blah, 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 blah. Or could we just have netball?
Could we just not have netball?
That's pretty much the solution I've come up with. I'm glad we saved this item to the end of the show, Amanda, because I realise now what a great way to close the show with a fully thought out idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, netball.
Love it. Yeah, yep. We used to play stall ball. It's a real like ladies game where you don't actually throw overarm at all. You have to stoop to throw the ball and you have to throw it underarm in a very ladylike manner.
what you're sort of describing there is bowls, essentially, isn't it?
It was bowls, but you had to hit a stick.
Oh. This sounds great.
It was.
Oh my God, no. Newsflash, the Swedish game of Cub.
Yeah. You know Cub.
I love Cub.
Yeah.
It's the best. Oh, my God. I actually feel like we have come to a conclusion. This is brilliant. The Swedish game of Cub, which is throwing sticks at other sticks.
And then also trying to hit the king stick, which is in the middle.
There's
which
a bigger
is
stick than all the other sticks.
Exactly, and has a tiny crown on it.
It's brilliant. Oh, yeah. Fab. Oh, well, there we go. Okay, so the solution is I'm going to present Top Gear with Evelyn, and mm-hmm. we are going to introduce Cub as the British national sport.
And Zane Malik is going to be our stick. Was that?
Who's going to be our stick?
Zane Miller.
Yes, there we go. Yeah, brilliant. Nice. I'd forgotten about him, but yes, he's going to be our stick and our stig. So thank you very much, Evelyn, for coming. It's been such
a pleasure, Lucy.
And I look forward to seeing your Edinburgh show. And we are going to be back next week. We're going to play out with another song from Dusty Springfield and also Carly Paradis. See ya.
Bye.
Like a circle in a spiral, like a wheel within a wheel.